This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 4095 for Friday, the 12th of April, 2024. Today's show is entitled 27 Years of Linux. It is hosted by Deltaray and is about 45 minutes long. It carries a clean flag. The summary is, Deltaray rambles on for 45 minutes and over-exaggerates about how awesome it is to use Linux.
Hello, Hacker Public Radio. So this is going to be an episode as a follow-up to Daniel Person's episode on 1 year of Linux, 1 year of using Linux as his desktop environment. And first of all, I applaud him for having the courage to try doing that for a year. It can be a daunting task to move from one operating system to another. And so, wow, you've been using Linux for 1 year. I've been using Linux as my desktop for probably around 24, 25 years, somewhere around there. And I've been using Linux overall for about 27 years. So this is mostly an episode that's about a different perspective and maybe somebody who's seeing things from, you know, down in the weeds and maybe looking up at the sky and wondering, you know, was it all worth it? Is it the right thing to be doing? But mostly, you know, I feel that people should use whatever tools works for them. Like, I'm not somebody who advocates hardcore for somebody to switch to, you know, one editor or the other, or one operating system or the other. Everybody has different needs and interests, so, you know, use what works for you. And in fact, being able to have the freedom to use what works for you is one of the reasons that drew me to, it was called free software at the time, to begin with, because I always feel like, you know, when you buy a computer and when you buy software, you should have the right to do with it what you want, as long as it's legal. But there shouldn't be somebody that's like controlling you through it or something like that. And so this is one of the fundamental things that keeps me in the open source world, because I feel like I have that freedom, not just to view and modify the source code, but to be able to choose my own destiny. And I think that Mac users, you know, had that in mind too, when they choose to go with Mac operating system and so on. So even though things might be different now, the landscape has changed definitely, but, you know, people have fundamental feelings about how they should be able to use their stuff. When I started using Linux, it was in 1997, about the same time of year. So, you know, I think it was like at the end of March or beginning of April or so. So it's really been 27 years. And it took effort, you know, a lot of effort to actually get it just to run, to figure out what kind of hardware you'd want to use or be able to use to begin with. And I found out about Linux first from a girl who was in my computer science class. We just started talking and she was like, oh yeah, Linux, we should try installing it on some computer where it would work, because I had like a Pioneer Pentium system at the time that didn't really have the best hardware and maybe wasn't compatible. This was also at a time when virtual machines weren't available on PC class hardware yet, or generally at all on, you know, desktop computing hardware like microcomputers. Virtual machines had been around on mainframes and stuff like that for a couple decades, but VMware didn't become a thing until 1998. So the possibility of running something in a virtual machine wasn't really realistic until probably the end of 1998, 1999, but it was expensive to do so at when it first came out. So generally, you'd either have to dedicate a computer to running Linux and not have Windows on it at all, or use this concept of dual booting. And dual booting isn't, I don't know how much people do that nowadays, but it used to be a much bigger thing. People used to try to see how many operating systems they could fit on their computer. And there's this YouTuber named Cathode Ray Dude, I think is his name. And he recently discovered this piece of software called System Commander, which is like a dual booting menu, like a multi-boot menu, kind of like Grub, but like on drugs. You know, it was kind of a graphically impressive bootloader, you know, that lets you do a lot of configuration and everything like that. And so, you know, you could have like 7 different operating systems on your computer or something like that once. Why? Just for fun, I guess. But for the most part, if people wanted to experiment with Linux, they'd have to make some space on their Windows partition, make a new partition or two, and then install Linux and boot back and forth, because it was definitely the case that you couldn't do everything that you might need to for a business environment or for a job in Linux, or maybe just for fun. And you probably wanted to be able to reboot into Windows to play the latest games and stuff like that. I feel like all that has changed drastically now. And I have been full-time in Linux since about, you know, 99, 2000 time period, but I usually kept a Windows PC around to do some things. But I haven't had to really use Windows probably in about 15 years. You know, it's like I've been able to be away from it for a long time now. It's not all perfect, but it's pretty good. And I think that the move to cloud applications, you know, that started to happen in about 2010, 2011, and brought us things like Google Docs and Office 365 and various applications, you know, production applications that people are looking to do to make like documents that they want to share and stuff like that, has made it definitely easier for Linux users to coexist in work environments and stuff like that. So that's been very helpful. But at the beginning, it wasn't like that. Somebody might want to share a Word document with you, and you just have to say either, well, hold on, let me boot into Windows and I'll use, you know, my copy of Office to load it. Or, you know, you might have WordPerfect was an early word processing program that was commercial and provided a version for Linux that you might have. There was also Sun Office, which became OpenOffice and now is LibreOffice. And so that was another option that you might have. But in the early days, they might not read the whole format properly, and there might be like little formatting glitches and stuff like that. A lot of those have been fixed, although they're still not 100% perfect, but they're pretty good. Usually you run into problems with like macros and things that people add into documents that maybe don't fully function under the free Office alternatives. But you could still kind of coexist and just make the excuse that, you know, well, I'm a Linux user, I don't have those kind of tools. And Microsoft could have, you know, the argument is always, well, Microsoft could have made Office for Linux, you know, they could have actually written it so it works with it, but they probably didn't have much of a reason to, because the market was small. And in my experience, free software users don't really like to buy much, so they, you know, probably wouldn't have bought Office anyways or something. And people were working on free Office alternatives and stuff like that, so they probably just wait for that rather than spend, you know, the $300 or whatever it cost to get Office at the time, or $200, something like that. Thinking about why I use Linux, initially it was the, you know, just the interest in doing something different and trying something that was Unix, because in the early, you know, when I first started using the internet, we were always logging into Unix servers. This was in 93, 94. We were always like telnetting into Unix servers to run links, like to access web pages. Links was like the first web browser that was all text-based and stuff like that. And so you didn't have that on your computer. You actually used a telnet client to access a mainframe computer server to be able to run that program to access web pages. And then basically, if you wanted to see an image, you'd have Lynx download the image and then copy it to your computer using FTP or something like that, and then view it locally. So it was quite a process just to view an image on a web page. But, you know, Unix always seemed like this glorious operating system that was out of the hands of normal consumers. So being able to run it on your own PC was very attractive. And I remember the first time I opened up Pine, the email client that you would usually run through a telnet session. When I first ran Pine on the raw console on my own Linux system, it was really cool. You know, I was like, wow, I'm running Pine directly on my own console or something like that. It just seemed very surrealistic, like seeing a total eclipse for the first time or something like that. So that was one of the, you know, main attractions. Once I finally got X Windows working on Linux, which was quite an endeavor because a lot of video cards wouldn't work with it, and so I either had to wait for the drivers to become available for the video card I had. I think that's what I ended up doing, was I waited about 6 months or something from the time that I got Linux working on a computer to the time that I actually could run X, because the video card had finally been supported. The drivers had finally been written. And so you would use a different, you know, window managers were kind of all the rage, like which window manager did you want to try using? And the de facto window manager that a lot of people would use back then was called FVWM. And there was an initial FVWM version 1, but I started using it with version 2. And FVWM is like the ultimate configuration nightmare, or whatever you want to call it, or it's going to take up a lot of your time. It's gonna you're gonna want to customize it to your heart's content. And this led to a lot of people having opinions about how they want to actually use a desktop. One of the things that FVWM offered and wasn't available on, you know, Mac or Windows, was the ability to have these things called virtual desktops. Basically, being able to have one desktop and then move to another desktop to the left or right or up or down and keep the windows in place on each of those desktops was a very powerful paradigm. You know, you could kind of keep yourself organized, and you could run multiple programs at once, maybe multiple web browsers and applications and stuff like that on various desktops, and then move around between them so that you wouldn't have to, like, click on different applications in the start bar and kind of switch between your configurations. It increased productivity, you know, I thought. And then another feature that was useful was being able to have sticky windows. Sticky windows are basically where you can keep a window on each of the virtual desktops, so that when you move between them, the sticky window will stay on that, on the same screen. Like, you'll keep seeing it when you move around, and you can still use these things. The other big one was Focus Follows Mouse. It's also called Sloppy Focus. Well, Sloppy Focus is a form of Focus Follows Mouse, but this is something that Windows has only recently implemented. But basically, the way it works is when you move your mouse pointer over a window, it instantly gets focus. And you don't have to, like, click on it and stuff like that. This allows for interesting ways of working with windows, where you can actually keep a window over top of another window, and you don't have to worry about clicking on the window below it and having that window pop up above the window that's behind it. So, you know, if you're typing in a window below in just a small area of it, but what you want to keep a big browser window or something like that over top of that window that's below, you can move back to the browser window and do something in that browser window, like scroll or something like that, without it affecting the other window. And then when you need to type in the other window, like a command or something, maybe on a tutorial or something like that, you don't have to, like, bring that window up above the browser window or something like that. And so that's what Focus Follows Mouse allows for. Sometimes it can be, you know, very confusing for a new user. And so, you know, people who are new to Linux was like, I clicked on the wrong window, or I'm in the wrong window, typing in the wrong window, and then they find, you know, they do something wrong. So it's not for the faint of heart. But Windows actually allows for this feature now, decades after it was available on Linux. And the feature of virtual desktops is available on Mac for maybe the last 10 years or so. But again, 15 years after it was available on Linux, they finally saw the light. But Mac's virtual desktop feature only goes left and right, whereas on Linux it goes, you know, in any direction. So in a way, Linux, you know, X Windows and the different window managers that you could use had more features than the, you know, stereotypical GUIs that you think of when you think of a GUI. And so that, you know, that ability to control your environment and have advanced features that weren't available on Mac or Windows kept me on Linux for a long time, and have continued to keep me on Linux because they still haven't, you know, been well implemented on Windows or Mac. And I always, whenever I try one of those other operating systems, I'm just like, I'm missing this feature or whatever, or, you know, pop-ups are coming up in the way, or advertising or something like that. And it just becomes frustrating. So if you're interested in what kind of applications I actually use under Linux, both GUI and command line based, I use Firefox as my web browser, and I don't make any excuses about that. I feel strongly about Firefox being used as a web browser under open source software, and that's perhaps something saved best for another episode. But anyways, and whenever I come across a website that doesn't support Firefox well or something, I usually write to the webmaster and then probably get an earload of, well, nobody's using it or something like that. Well, they were for a long time. And it's the free open source alternative to all the other stuff that's out there that's spying on you. So, of course, I use Terminal Emulator. I have switched between a few different ones. Right now I'm using XFCE Terminal and also Kitty. Kitty is another terminal emulator that's pretty good. There's also Cool Retro Term that I occasionally fire up if I want like that retro nostalgic feeling of running on old terminal or something like that. And then I have like a big menu that's up in my XFCE panel. I use XFCE as my window manager because it aligns with my preferences the best. And so I have this big menu that has a bunch of applications in it that I use frequently. The first one on the list is always GIMP. I do a fair amount of image editing and photo editing and stuff like that because I am kind of a visual person. I end up, you know, taking pictures of stuff and then, you know, playing with the photo in GIMP in some way or something like that. Recently, I've also gotten into selling stuff on eBay, and so I'm often using GIMP for quickly doing post-production of the images before they go up on the sale. The next one is GNUmeric. GNUmeric was part of the GNOME Office Suite. There used to be this project to create an office suite for GNOME that was all open source software. And so I forget what the other applications were for it, but GNUmeric was the spreadsheet one. And I like GNUmeric a lot because it's fairly lightweight, so it starts up really fast. It's pretty functional, you know. It's like I've never run into a case really where something didn't work in it, and it supports all the normal Excel functionality and stuff like that. It also supports Perl plugins and regular expressions and stuff like that. So yeah, it's a pretty full-featured one. That's spelled GNUmeric, and it's still maintained after all these years, and there's pretty good following of it. The next thing I have set up is a quick script to actually open up the Thunar. I think it's pronounced Thunar. That's the way I pronounce it. The file manager for XFCE is called Thunar. And so basically I have a script to open up like a local directory and my phone directory, so I can quickly transfer files from my phone to like a drive that I have for doing backups of phones and stuff like that. The next one I have, which is kind of unique, is Hipnotix. Hipnotix is a program for actually watching TV online. There's a few of these types of applications, but Hipnotix is like an easy one. I don't actually run that very much, but I just play around with it once in a while to see what's going on TV around the world and stuff like that. And then a recent one that I've discovered and enjoy is Flameshot. I like to take screenshots of web pages whenever there's something on it that I know won't be able to be captured by like saving the page or printing it out or something like that. So I'll take screenshots and stuff, or I'll take screenshots of error messages or for demonstrations and stuff. So Flameshot is a nice GUI screenshot program that kind of gets out of the way. I also use another command line based screenshot tool called Scrot, C-R-O-T, and that works pretty well too. But Flameshot allows you to do annotations very quickly, instead of having to like fire up GIMP and you know mess with all that. Flameshot's a lot better at that. Then I have Mousepad. Even though I'm a Vim user, I do have Mousepad sometimes. It's kind of nice for being able to just paste in text or something like that. Also, since it's not a terminal window, I don't have to worry as much if I paste something in there, if it has like escape codes or whatever that's going to mess something up. So I kind of use Mousepad as like a, you know, a notepad type of application and stuff like that. Inkscape, this is like Adobe Illustrator. You know, it's a vector graphics program. I use that sometimes for making like posters or flyers or something, and it works really well. It's come a long ways. It's also good for, you know, making like icons or diagrams or something like that. And I've been doing some of that recently for like a class I'm teaching and stuff. Then the next one I have, which I haven't really opened up in a while because I haven't need to, is the Pulse Audio Volume Control. That's like PAVUCTL is the name of the program, I think. And it's for, you know, opens up that Pulse Audio application that you can usually access by just clicking on the volume icon and clicking on Audio Mixer. So this is just another place for it. And then KeePass X, which is actually KeePass XC, which is what I use now, but that's a password manager database program that's local and keeps your passwords in an encrypted database locally, which I highly recommend you do for security purposes. The next one below that is the KVM Virtual Machine Manager. This is just a way of running virtual machines under Linux, and this is the management interface to it, so I can quickly open that up. And you probably noticed by now, there's really not a lot of good categorization to how I have these organized. They're not in alphabetical order or anything. It's kind of just like I laid them out this way, or I added them to the menu this way and haven't really looked back and tried to organize them better. The next one below that is Blender. I've been a Blender user since 1998, and I've been into 3D modeling since I had an Amiga back in 1990. So I've been doing 3D modeling and animation for a long time, and it's just a hobby of mine. I'm not great at it or whatever, but it's fun for me, and it, you know, brings back fond memories and stuff like that. But so I have Blender in the menu here, and instead of installing Blender from a package management system, it's one that I actually download and put it into like a bin directory manually, because it's being updated so frequently that waiting for, you know, a package to come through the package management system, you're going to be running a very old version. So yeah. And then below that, FreeCAD. FreeCAD is like a free CAD program, as the name implies. And it's pretty good. There's kind of an intense learning curve to it, but once you figure it out, you can make precisely modeled models drawings. And I use that for making 3D printed stuff when I need to have exact measurements. So that's what FreeCAD is good for. Below that, Simple Screen Recorder. This is an application for being able to take videos of your screen, and it works pretty well. It's pretty lightweight and everything, has a lot of features. So if you ever need to like demonstrate the use of of some application or your desktop or something like that. It's good for that. Below that, I have the printer, the FlashForge printer control software for my 3D printer. Below that, I have VirtualBox, which I've moved away from, Oracle's VirtualBox. And the main reason I moved away from it is because the VirtualBox extensions are something that you need to get a license for and pay for, but the minimum charge for actually getting one of those licenses is that you have to buy like 50 of them, something like that. You have to buy a crazy number of them, and they cost $200 each or something like that, and you end up having to pay $6,000 just to get one license because you have to buy 50 of them or something like that, which is just so stupid. Oracle, if you're listening to this, which probably you aren't, but come on, can we do this a little bit better? Below that, I have Rhythmbox, which is like a, you know, music playing software, which I don't really use that much. I probably could remove this from this menu, this quick access menu. I tend to use like MPV or MPG123 from the command line just because, I don't know, I like doing it better that way, playing my music and stuff like that. If I was going to use a GUI thing, I'd probably use like XMMS2 or, you know, one of the things that looks like old Winamp or whatever, because that's, you know, when I think of playing music on the computer, I think of it that way. And below that is Zoom. I am often in video conferences where I have to, you know, talk to colleagues and stuff like that. I've been a Zoom user since like 2 years before the pandemic, and because we used it at work a lot. And it works pretty well. And then below that is Gramps. Gramps is a genealogy program that's pretty good. It's pretty full featured. It has, you know, the ability to store everything in the GEDCOM format and all that, which is like a universal format for genealogy and other formats too. And then, you know, you can put in like pictures and media and stuff like that. So if you're into genealogy, check out Gramps. It's just like GRAMPS. Below that, I have the Qt V4L2 test utility, which, yeah, that's a mouthful. But this is a Qt widget set GUI application for controlling your webcam. And this is, you know, you can control like the contrast, brightness, zoom, and stuff like that, like how, you know, how much it's zoomed in and all that. And this is something that you can't easily do under Windows and Mac. And when I was using this once on a Zoom call, people are like, how are you doing that? I'm like, well, I have this test utility that's free and stuff. And then below that is Godot. Godot is a game making engine that I've gotten into because my son and I have, you know, tried to make some games together and stuff like that. And so he's really gotten into it. And so that's a free open source game making engine that works really well. When Blender, I discovered it when Blender dropped their game engine. A lot of people were disappointed, but Blender was like, hey, there's better game engines out there or something like that are free even. And they weren't talking about, you know, the big commercial ones that now have weird licensing. But Godot is one that's lightweight, does 3D and 2D. And stuff, and works pretty well. It has a learning curve like any of them, but people have used them to make commercial games even. So check that out, spelled G-O-D-O-T. And then below that, which probably should be much higher up in the list, is Krita. Krita is a graphics, it's a raster graphics program like GIMP, but the focus is on drawing. There's a program that was called Fractal Design Sketcher back in the day that was all about drawing on the computer, not about photo manipulation necessarily, but provide you with a bunch of different features. But Krita is basically an open source version of that and really is awesome. It's in my opinion, it's actually surpassed GIMP in many ways in its functionality and everything. And sometimes I actually use Krita instead of GIMP for doing photo manipulation. Especially when it comes to like adding text, GIMP and Inkscape could really do a better job with text manipulation, I think. I don't know. It's kind of a pain sometimes. And then below that, Arduino. I get into circuit design and Arduino programming. Arduino is like the microcontroller the microcontroller module that you can use for doing like fun circuits and stuff like that and making little projects. And so that's the IDE for it, so that you can actually upload your projects to an Arduino. And then below that is a speech to text program that's called speech to text. Oh, it's called Nerd Dictation. So Nerd Dictation was this nice open source software where you didn't have to send off your speech to the cloud to have it turned into something. All the learning data was kept on your own computer. That way you kept things a bit more private. I discovered this after I actually smashed my, this is going to trigger some people, but after I smashed my finger in the car door twice, I did it twice. And I ended up having to have my right hand in like a cast type of thing. And that made it really hard to type, of course. So I discovered this Nerd Dictation software so I could actually say stuff and like write out an email and stuff like that pretty quickly. So check out Nerd-Dictation if you're interested in that kind of thing. And I made like a little toggling script so that I could just press like F9 or something like that and I could turn it on or off really easily. So that's that. And those are, most of the programs I use. I also use Audacity. I've gotten into audio production a bit, and there's a bunch there. Yoshimi is a really cool software synthesizer. It's called Yoshimi after Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots by the Flaming Lips. It's spelled Yoshimi. If you like MIDI and synthesis and stuff like that, check that out. There's also a free audio synthesis Eurorack simulator that's called VCV Rack 2. I don't think it's open source, but it's freely downloadable. And that allows you to do interesting things with like waveform development and stuff. And that can be a lot of fun to just play with. Hydrogen is a drum machine you can hook up. And audio production in Linux has really come a long ways. If you really get into it, there's a whole bunch of cool stuff that you can do around using PipeWire. PipeWire is like a replacement for Pulse Audio, and it allows you to like connect applications together and like use the output from sound from one application going into another application stuff. And this stuff just wasn't available like 15 years ago when I was doing audio production before. When I was using programs like Reason and stuff like that under Windows. And so, yeah, if you like audio production and you just haven't tried it on Linux, look around. There's a whole bunch of cool stuff. Karla is a program for like setting up a audio production rack and connecting these applications together and stuff like that. Audacity has always been a great program for doing waveform editing and stuff like that, and that's open source. Rose Garden is good for audio production and stuff. There's a bunch of them, so check it out. There's a cool YouTuber named Unfi, UNFI, and he goes over a lot of these applications that you can check out. And as far as games go, I play, my favorite game to play is Stardew Valley. That's this farming game that was really, really well produced by one person. Like the music, the dialogue, the programming, and the graphics were all made by one person, Eric Barone, over a four-year period, and he did a really great job. And then Minecraft, I play Minecraft with my son. Steam works under Linux, so that allows for a whole bunch of games to work natively under Linux, or makes it easier to actually get games that work under Wine to work using a program called Proton. So a whole bunch of games work under Linux now, folks. If you haven't been paying attention and you just have gotten out of games because you got discouraged by it not working under Linux, guess what? A lot of games work under Linux now, so check it out. And then Warzone 2100, SimCity 2000, SimCity 3000, Flight Gear, which is like a flight simulator, Nexius, which is like an open source first-person shooter, Terraria, which is a closed-sourced 2D game kind of like Minecraft, but is fun to play, and Super Tux Kart, which has come a long ways as well, Super Tux 2, which is like a, you know, Mario type of platformer, Oni, which is like a first-person shooter from about 24 years ago or so that I like to play, BeamNG, which is this cool closed-source driving simulator that works from Steam, and so on. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of really cool stuff out there. Check it out. And then those are all like the big ones that I probably use on a regular basis. The other thing I do that's related to Firefox is I try to keep, you know, work and different things separated from each other. So I use Firefox profiles to basically have like a personal data, a work data, which now I've moved into a virtual machine completely. So it's completely isolated. And then also one for CLI Magic, because I run the CLI Magic Twitter and Mastodon accounts. And so I have a separate profile for that. I have a separate one for various different, you know, things that I do and stuff like that. So there's all kinds of cool things that you can do when you have control. I remember when GIMP, the GNU image manipulation program, came out, or at least when it was starting to become noticed, like through a Slashdot post or something like that. It had the way the GIMP interface was set up was that like every function or menu in GIMP had a separate window. So like the toolbar was a separate window from the actual image display. And that was a separate window from the layers toolbox, and various toolbox had their own windows. And people would complain about, you know, GIMP being difficult to use, especially once they made GIMP for Windows and they had the same kind of windowing paradigm and stuff like that. And people would often, you know, who were used to using Photoshop and stuff, they would say, why can't GIMP just have one window and everything like that? But those people didn't really understand that the way people used X Windows and everything was to use these sticky windows and to put windows on other monitors and stuff like that, because it was pretty likely that a Linux desktop user would have multiple monitors and be able to put them across to, you know, toolbars on their monitors, do interesting windowing tricks to the various windows. So there's quite a powerful way to use GIMP by having those multiple windows and everything kind of broken out. But it's also useful to be able to keep everything in one window, so it's also good that they added the single window mode later. But it's not to go without saying that there was no use to having the multiple window paradigm to it. The concept of window managers in general led to a lot of people having strong opinions about which one that they would like. And so Linux, you know, as a desktop, is all about choice. You know, it's all about having those choices of being able to do what you want. There's people who like GNOME. There's people who like KDE. There's people who like I use XFCE because it's probably the most lightweight thing that's very much like FVWM. But then there's people, you know, who like to use, what's it called, Nomad or Awesome or something like that, or IceWM. You know, there's all these different window managers that you can use that will work with the windows and provide panels in a different way. And that's a great thing. But of course, this leads to support issues when commercial software wants to make Linux applications, or even when various, you know, open source applications want to make something, they have to think about all the different window paradigms that there are out there, and sometimes they get frustrated with it and stuff. With this choice comes the cost of support. Recently, I've noticed that, and there was a YouTube video about this, about how software is getting worse, generally because it takes a lot of effort to make GUI applications and software in general. And so people are kind of getting worse at making it because it's probably no longer as sexy to actually make software as it once was. And maybe the people who are really good at it have moved on to other things. And now we're stuck with people who don't know as well how to make good software, and they're not making as good of choices when they make software, and they're also not testing it as well. So you end up with lots more errors than you did before. And as somebody who uses Google Docs and also Office 365 in a browser for work purposes, I can say that, you know, those programs really kind of suck. You know, they just trying to use them for general document creation is a pain. And I'm finding that LibreOffice is actually ahead of the game now in terms of usability. And maybe open source has a big opportunity here to actually leap ahead as far as providing people with a great interface for application software, because the people who make open source software are doing it with a passion, right? Blender is a great example of this. Blender was this, you know, 3D modeling application that originally it was kind of a, you know, a daunting thing to learn, and everything was in a weird place, and it was hard to understand. But that kind of went along with 3D modeling and animation software in general, because that kind of stuff is hard to do and hard to represent in a normal window GUI paradigm that you commonly see. So they have to make all kinds of special functions and stuff. But the passion that people have had behind Blender have just greatly improved it over the past 30 years. It's gone from this, you know, obtuse, hard to use program to something that is much easier to use and much more like its commercial competitors, and maybe even leaping ahead of the commercial options a bit in some ways. But it's definitely become a lot easier to use in the past 5 years. You know, just it's grown by leaps and bounds. And I hope that some of the other GUI application developers can see the kind of the model that the Blender team has used and maybe learn from that and get better themselves. So yeah, that's my thoughts on using Linux over the past 27 years and how things have changed, gotten easier. You know, you can play games in Linux now. I remember when I used to play Diablo 2, you know, and back in 2000, it was this game that, you know, was very popular, and you couldn't play that on Linux until later when Wine started supporting it, and you could actually play Diablo 2 under Linux. But that wasn't until like maybe, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years later after it had been released. But Diablo 3 was supported under Wine on day one, and I was able to play it all the way through inside of Linux from, you know, from the release day without any problems. You know, it worked completely, and that just blew me away. One of the other advantages to playing games on our Linux is that speed is one. Some people have reported, and I've seen personally, faster frame rates under Linux than under Windows by just, you know, maybe a couple more frames per second. That can mean a lot to a hardcore gamer. But this is because Linux has better memory management and maybe a little bit less overhead than Windows does. You can also do interesting things with the windows. Wine allows you to run applications in their own virtual desktop window. So it's like having a virtual machine window, and it dedicates it to it. But that allows you to do things like have a window that's not full screen under Linux, but is still containing the full screen game inside of a window that's on the Linux desktop that's almost the size of the full desktop. So you can kind of get that full screen effect without completely taking up the whole screen and still being able to see like your desktop panel or whatever else, or maybe some other application or something like that. And being able to move between virtual desktops. So like I was back when I was playing World of Warcraft under Linux, you know, I could keep that running in its own dedicated window and be able to move away from it without like alt tabbing and stuff like that. Like I could move to another desktop, go to my browser real quick, and then go back to World of Warcraft, and World of Warcraft was fine. Whereas on a Windows system, using Alt-Tab to get out of the game would cause problems or make it so that the application might quit, or they might say, well, you're cheating or something like that. So you know, playing games under Linux can actually be a more pleasant experience and more flexible. Okay, well, I probably rambled on enough. I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are about using Linux as a desktop as well. So please share them in the comments, and I'll talk to you later. Bye.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HBR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.